We're talking in the last class about one of the things that Prabhupada used to do with the devotees in general was that he was very accepting. So he never made you feel like something was wrong with you. We made ourselves feel like we were inadequate, but he never made us feel that way. So it's very interesting, because a lot of devotees felt very inadequate to serve Prabhupada, because he was so pure. But he never made us feel that way. And who was saying that? Just yesterday, the day before, somewhere, someone was saying that when Prabhupada was in Mayapur and they greeted him, and he saw the devotees and he said, "Actually, I'm unqualified. I'm not qualified to be your spiritual master." He said, "Because you're doing everything." So he never made us feel bad. Even he didn't want us to feel bad because we were bad. He wanted us to feel good because we were engaged in Krishna consciousness. It was always about Krishna consciousness is wonderful. It wasn't about you're bad. Krishna consciousness is wonderful, but you're bad, so forget it. It wasn't never like that. It was like Krishna consciousness is wonderful and you're taking it to it, so that makes everything wonderful. How we were really, he never really saw our disqualification as disqualification. He just saw our sincerity as qualification, and that qualification would override any disqualification. And so, could you close that door? Where's that coming from? So, So, when we notice our faults, then there's a tendency, better not touch it, it's working. When we see our faults, there's a tendency, there can be a tendency to just become, can you close the door? There can be a tendency become discouraged, sometimes even think, why bother? The only time Prabhupada, I wouldn't say Prabhupada discouraged us, he would chastise us for doing something wrong. But you see, when we do something wrong, we tend to think there's something wrong with us. But Prabhupada never made us feel there was anything wrong with us, he always just made us understand, you did something wrong. It was like, there's two things, you know. You're bad and you do something wrong are two different things. You're fine, you just did something wrong. We think if I do something wrong, there's something wrong with me, right? He never made you feel that way, ever. It was like you did something wrong. Okay, you did something wrong, so what are you going to do now? You know, sometimes he could be a little cutting and sarcastic with his intimate people who he was depending on. But that was the exception. But with the general devotees, no one ever felt anything but inspiration. And one time when Prabhupada was asked, why are you traveling all over the world? Because I would say from around 1974, he wasn't staying anywhere very long. Before that, he would stay long. He'd go somewhere, stay in Hawaii for a few months, Los Angeles for a few months, translate, stay in India for a few months. After that, 74, 75, 77, it was just moving. So then they asked him, why are you moving so much? He said, to inspire my disciples. So it would have been obviously counterproductive that everywhere he went, he would just find fault with everybody and everybody would become depressed and discouraged. Because what could be more devastating than to have your spiritual master continually tell you there's something wrong with you? Right? You would be convinced there's something wrong with you. You'd be pretty dysfunctional. So And we were talking about that in the last class, how as young devotees, if you were to say, compared to us now, there was a lot more wrong with us then than there is now, but there was a lot more optimism and enthusiasm in many cases then than now. So this had nothing to do with humility, it just had to do with being spiritually optimistic, and so Prabhupada kept us very optimistic. And the other thing is, Prabhupada, he was dealing with what he would sometimes call us his monkey soldiers, so he was dealing with us. And at the same time, he would tell us how Krishna consciousness is going to spread all over the world. So if it's going to spread all over the world, who's going to do it? The monkey soldiers. So he wasn't discouraged by the monkey soldiers. Because he had, you know, in a sense, he could be discouraged. Because you just look at us, right? Not Brahmins, not really highly qualified, but very, very dark samskaras. But he wasn't encouraged. And so one time, one of our god sisters, in maybe 1970, 71, she was going through a series of discouraging situations. Being a woman in ISKCON was sometimes difficult. And, you know, there's always this tendency to find fault with one another, discourage one another. So she went to Prabhupada and she just said, I give up. I quit, that's it, I can't take it. And Prabhupada told her, you have no right to be discouraged. I have a right to be discouraged. Nobody else has a right. But I'm not discouraged. Then he went on to explain how he didn't get help from even one god brother. Nobody helped him. He had to do it all himself. And not only that, some tried to hinder him. So if anyone had a reason to be discouraged, it was him. But he was never discouraged. And he was never discouraged by us. So, I remember one letter. So we're jumping ahead because I'm just thinking of letters and I don't want to forget. But I was very involved in book distribution for many years. And at one point, I was kind of taking the role of helping book distribution on the west coast of America. So that was from Vancouver in Canada to San Diego, maybe like 1,200, 1,500 miles. And I would go to the different temples and spend a week or so at each temple. So then I thought in that capacity, I should write Prabhupada and tell him what's going on, how many books and what I'm doing. Just, you know, sometimes out of the blue, we just did. I mean, we knew where to write, so nobody, it wasn't like anybody could stop you. They might tell you not to write, but they didn't know you were writing because you just went to the post office. But, you know, we didn't. We knew we shouldn't write a lot, so I think I only wrote. After I was temple president, I think I only wrote 3 letters. 2 sannyas requests, and this letter. So in this letter, I was explaining to Prabhupada what I was doing and how the book distribution was going on. And the idea was if we would write Prabhupada with book distribution scores, he would become very happy. So, you know, if you could make Prabhupada happy, then you felt perfect. So I wanted to say something about book distribution, let Prabhupada know that I was doing some book distribution. And then he wrote back and he said that, always encourage the devotees in book distribution or in preaching or in anything. And he said, and then you'll always be enthused. So that was Prabhupada's formula. You just always encourage. You know. Now sometimes when we become discouraged, it's pretty hard to encourage others, isn't it? So the Prabhupada's formula is, you encourage, you'll be encouraged. If you're upset by other people, you get discouraged. We all know that, right? So encourage others, and you will always be encouraged. And it's true. And about 3 years ago, I attended a workshop done by a company who was kind of a Buddhist-based kind of teaching. And they were explaining something very interesting in their company. It was quite a big company. They're all over the world. And they explained that in their company, they realized that any time anyone complained or anything negative came back, like people would want their money back, or they're complaining about something that went on in their company, any time that happened, created a big negative energy and influence in the company. And they could monitor that influence in terms of sales, number of students, and so forth. So through their own work, they realized that if you put out positive, no matter what comes to you, if you put out positive, then the positive tends to come back. So then they created a formula. I don't know where this idea came from, but they created this idea that anytime something negative comes, you have to give out positive 5 times. So let's say they got a negative letter, then they might write 5 positive, just go to their mailing list and write 5 positive letters. I just, you know, want to thank you again for coming to our workshop, and I really appreciate the time you took, like that. So every time they got anything negative, they would do 5 positives. And they said they were at somewhere, it was like, of all the correspondence they were getting, about 20% or 18% was negative. And by doing the 5 times positive, within 3, 4, 5, I forget how long, I think it was about 3, 4 months, it went down to 2% negative, and it stayed there, and it never got higher than that. Isn't that interesting? So there's another interesting thing. This is so interesting. You probably know, we were talking about this in past classes, that around 1970, Prabhupada was very concerned that there were influences within our organization that could destroy it. And he was in a lot of anxiety. And I didn't know that. And the interesting thing was, I was at the temple in Los Angeles when this was going on. And I read in the Lilamrita what was going on for Prabhupada. And he was in a lot of anxiety. I think he wasn't sleeping much at night. And he was very concerned about the welfare of the movement, because he felt that there were people in India trying to poison it. And some of the poison had crept in, and some of the disciples had been poisoned. And he saw symptoms of that. And that's why he went, in the end of 1970, he went back to India, because he felt his disciples were offending him. And he actually wanted to get away. And he was in front of the deities, and the deities said, go. They actually told him, leave. So the interesting thing was, I read all about this in the Lilamrita. I had no idea. And why it's interesting is because I was there with Prabhupada. There was no indication in his dealings, in his demeanor, or in anything that there was anything going wrong. When he was with us, giving Bhagavatam class, doing morning walks, there was no indication that something was going on. Negative. It was just the same blissful, positive, forceful, enthusiastic spiritual master. So when I read all this, I was really surprised. I said, that's amazing. I didn't know that was going on. I had no idea. If you're upset, it's in your face. It's in your energy level. You immediately, like Hari Dhamma, we haven't seen one another for a while, right? So you kind of know what we're like. So if we see one another and we're not like we used to be, immediately you can understand something must be wrong. You know, like he's not smiling, or he's like, he's always looking down. No, he didn't used to be that way. You immediately know. With Prabhupada, it didn't show. So it was really interesting. A lot of times Prabhupada was sick, and we didn't know. We couldn't tell, because he was always going. And of course, we were in our 20s, and he was in his 70s, and we didn't know what it was like to be 70, but he was always dancing. He was always moving, so we never looked at him as old. We never saw him in terms of years. And it was his energy that gave everyone else energy. So this is very, I think it's very important that we deal with ourselves the way Prabhupada dealt with us. That if there's something wrong with us, if there's something we don't do well, or we're not achieving what we want to achieve, we find so many anarthas, it doesn't mean we're bad. It just means we're a work in progress. And what Prabhupada taught us is, be happy about Krishna consciousness. Don't be unhappy about your condition. Be happy about Krishna consciousness. That's what's blissful. And that's how we were. We were happy about Krishna consciousness. We weren't unhappy about ourselves. We were just happy about Krishna consciousness. I don't remember in the early days of the movement, devotees really being too concerned about their fallen condition. And the reason is that things were so spiritually energized and ecstatic, I don't think that even was part of anyone's mentality. It's like things were so blissful that you couldn't really perceive that they weren't blissful, even if you had a reason to not be blissful. Does that make sense? It's like there may be something wrong with your own devotion, but the atmosphere was so surcharged that it didn't really bother you, because you're surrounded by such good sangha and kirtan and class and surrender that it just, your own defects would never bother you, because the atmosphere was so nice. So that's the way Prabhupada dealt with us, and I just wanted to bring this up because I think we need to deal with ourselves this way. And if you look at it from a philosophical point of view, in the Manusamhita, there's a saying that Brahmins, they don't lament. Shudras lament, right? Isn't that what Shudra means? One who laments, Prabhupada says in the Gita. Shudra means one who laments. So Shudras is considered generally to be governed by the mode of ignorance. So that if you put two and two together, it means lamentation is caused by the mode of ignorance. I'm so bad. I'm so stupid. I'm so whatever. And then that handicaps you. So because you think you're bad or you're stupid, you just lament. And when you're lamenting, you don't do anything. Most of your energy is spent lamenting. You don't have much energy left to do anything positive. Right? So, in the Manusamhita it says, the Brahmins never lament. Like if a person's depressed, it's not Brahminical. Because Brahmins are in Sattvagun. And Sattvagun, there's nothing about depression in Sattvagun. So what Manusamhita says, if a Brahmin makes a mistake or does something wrong, he just gets up and continues. He doesn't lament. And that's how Prabhupada dealt with us. If he did something wrong, basically, what he would say is, what are you going to do now? That was the mood. Not like you're such a fool, idiot, useless, and so forth. He would say, what are you going to do now? So how can we rectify it? That's all. So everything was very positive. That's Brahminical. Sattvagun. It's always going forward. Tamagun is always inertia. I'm so bad, I can't do anything. Right? Now, if you know anything about psychology, you'll know that many, many people in the world are infested with this kind of mentality, that I'm bad, I'm not very smart, or I don't deserve God's mercy or God's love. It's very, very common. It's probably going to become worse as Kali Yuga progresses. But no one ever felt that way in Prabhupada's presence. And the interesting thing is, Prabhupada didn't have to tell us, no, there's nothing wrong with you, think positive and so on. That's just how he dealt with us. Like nowadays, preachers might say, no, do affirmations, I am healthy, I am powerful, I am this or that, right? But Prabhupada didn't do that. It's just how he treated us. It's really interesting if you think about it. We felt very powerful and very enthusiastic and very creative and intelligent, and we did all kinds of amazingly wonderful and also stupid things, but we weren't afraid to do stupid things, and if we did, it didn't bother us. We would just correct it. So we were able to have all this encouragement without having to be preached to, no, you're not bad, you're good, and so forth, because that's how Prabhupada dealt with us. So it's a very good lesson that we should deal with ourselves that way, and we should deal with other people that way. I once read that one way to encourage children is to tell them that they have the quality that you want them to develop. So let's say you want them to be polite. So you say to them, I know you won't do this because you're too polite to do that. Because you're such a polite child, I know, I can trust you won't do this. Or, you know, the mother says, don't do that. And the father says, no, she's too smart to do that. So you're reinforcing the behavior that you want them to have by telling them that they have it. It's like that story, you know the story? I don't know the details, but the story of the criminal in the village that you made on the poster in the village. It's a criminal, right? He does something and then they bring him and everyone in the village glorifies them. They don't say anything bad, they only say good things about him, and then what? He feels so guilty because he's being honored, and he feels so guilty that he let everybody down. And so they're reinforcing, you're so wonderful, so smart, so intelligent, that it makes him feel bad, and in that way he repents and rectifies. Is that correct? Yeah, it's very, really interesting, isn't it? So you could say in a sense Prabhupada was like that. It was if you did something wrong, he'd correct it, but he never made you feel that beyond that one mistake there was any problem in your life. It was just that one little incident that happened within this time frame. And then that's all. The normal was, I can see that you're sincere, I can see that you're intelligent, I can see that Krishna is giving you creative intelligence to do this. That was the general tone, and that's how Prabhupada empowered. That's how he empowered people. Because Prabhupada understood that our strength and intelligence to spread Krishna consciousness is Krishna Shakti. It's not Maya Shakti. And that Krishna Shakti comes through sadhana. By good sadhana and adherence to his orders, we get Krishna Shakti. And when he saw Krishna Shakti manifesting, then he would affirm it. I can see Krishna's giving you intelligence because you're sincere. He would just affirm that that's what's happening. And that makes it happen more. When you affirm something that's good, then a person repeats that behavior or it becomes more connected to that action. So that's what he was doing. Prabhupada was seeing what Krishna was doing and then he was affirming it. Haribo! Oh, the lights just went out, but as long as the power comes back in 10 minutes, we'll still be okay. So, should we do a mystical meditation now? The light's just on me, right? I must look very mystical.
I can see you
levitating. So Prabhupada was always acknowledging the devotees. And acknowledging that they're connected to Krishna, they're getting Krishna's mercy, and Krishna was giving intelligence. Now it's going to get really windy. We're all going to stay here tonight, right? Oh. Okay. So, I told the story that I went to Vancouver as a young devotee, and in the time I was there, which was about a year and a half, maybe 15 to 20 people joined. And we opened a second temple, and it was all kind of just happening. At least not happening by strategic planning, happening by strategic prayer. You know the difference? Strategy is being clear about what you want to achieve. Strategic planning is planning to do it. Strategic prayer is not planning, it's just praying. So we didn't have the intelligence to plan how to do it, but we had the sincerity to strategically pray for it. So we knew what we wanted, and we prayed for it. And that's how it happened. And so then, and then Prabhupada, as I said, Prabhupada told the GBC, he said, well, Mahatma must be sincere, otherwise, why is Krishna sending devotees? So Prabhupada was recognizing this like spiritual connection in the sincerity of his disciples. And so he was appreciating sincerity. Like for us sometimes, if somebody does something wrong, does something that's not intelligent, or makes a mistake, even after you've told them how to do it, we tend to notice that and become upset by it, right? Maybe more so than we see the intelligence or guidance that Krishna gives. But Prabhupada was more focused on the guidance, the guidance Krishna was giving because of the sincerity. Because it says that the pure devotee or the elevated devotee, that's what they see. They see good. It's like the conditioned soul when you're in the modes of nature. There's some, whatever mode you're in, you're attracted. It attracts other modes, similar modes. So when you're in ignorance, you're attracted to seeing other people's faults. That's something like that's your rasa. You get a taste from seeing other people's faults, pointing them out, and putting them down, because their actions are in tamagun. So you have to be in tamagun to want to talk about it. So like a lot of devotees, they ask me, they say, what do you think? What do you do when somebody says this to you, or deals with you this way, or somebody mistreats someone else, or this or that? What do you think about it? And I usually say, I don't think about it. And I ask them a rhetorical question. I say, why should I think about it? It doesn't do me any good. It doesn't, it's not, it just, basically it's pretty depressing to think about it. Abraham Lincoln said that, when I see people act in wrong ways, it just teaches me how I don't want to behave. So he saw it, you know, someone's actions are bad, but he saw it in a good way. So he wasn't going into the mode of ignorance. But when you're in the mode of ignorance, naturally when you'll see others' activities in ignorance, then you just vibrate on that frequency, so that's where your mind is, so that's that's where you get your taste. You understand? Yeah. Yeah. If someone is doing something wrong and you notice what they're doing wrong more than what they're doing right, it's because you're operating on that level. That's what gives you pleasure. Like, for example, if you... Sounds like bodies are flying around out there. People are screaming as they're... as the wind is blowing them by, they're going right by the windows. No, the wind is just, it's just picking up devotees and throwing them around, and they're screaming. And they're screaming. So, one time here in Mayapur, Prabhupada was taking his walk, and at that time, they didn't have much in the way of toilets, so they would dig a hole in the ground and maybe put some wood over the hole to squat on, and then they would just put up, I don't know what, bamboo or wood or something. And those were the bathrooms that we used for the festival. And that pukur, by Prabhupada's samadhi, that's where we bathed. That's where I bathed. We lived on the boundary wall in rooms that were about this height. We had a squat. We're about 5 feet high, which means about this, up to our chest. We couldn't stand up. We lived in those rooms. We bathed in the pukur, and then we went in that little house, and the rest of the time we were sick because they gave us water that was not digestible. So when Prabhupada, he was walking by and he could see in this, what we call in America, we call it an outhouse. What do they call it in India? They don't have a name because it's like a portable toilet, basically. So he saw it was dirty. And he said, you should get it clean. And they said, okay, we'll clean it later. And he said, no. They said, we're chanting now, we'll clean it later. And he said, no, clean it now. Don't use chanting as an excuse. But he made a really important point. And he said that, why is it that I notice this and I'm bothered by it and you're not bothered by it? And he said, because like modes don't, if you're in the mode of ignorance, the mode of ignorance doesn't bother you. It's only if you're in the mode of goodness will the mode of ignorance bother you. For example, you go into somebody's room and it's a total mess. It's dirty, it's disorganized. If you're very sattvic, you won't even want to be in that room. You'll just say, can we talk? You just look at that room, it's like, I can't be here. Because it's too disorganized, right? But if you're like, if you're in that mode, then when you go in that room, you don't even notice. In fact, you feel kind of good. You feel at home in that room, right? So he's making the same point. If you're not clean and you see something else that's not clean, it doesn't bother you. But if you're very clean, it bothers you. So the point I'm making is that a pure devotee, because he doesn't dwell in passion and ignorance, he doesn't dwell in people's faults. There's no rasa for him in dwelling in people's faults. When you're mode of ignorance, there's actually a rasa there. You get some pleasure from it, right? You know, in America, there's radio shows, and all they do is talk about how bad politicians are and how bad their policies are, and people relish that. It's complete mode of ignorance. Maybe a drop of passion, but mostly ignorance. And there's a relish there in that katha, putting people down. There is a taste. If you're in ignorance, you'll get a taste. And people who are more sattvic, they'll never listen to that. In fact, there's one doctor, he's a naturopathic doctor, and one of his prescriptions for health is to throw away your television or sell it and buy a juicer and have juice every day. But the television is toxic, not because of the radiation, but because of what it's bringing into your mind. So anyway, because Prabhupada was elevated, he would see the good and he would always acknowledge the good and encourage it. Thank you for doing this. Now, the interesting thing is, as God brothers, we knew one another very well. So we knew that a lot of the ways in which we serve were not really, you could say, brahminical or the best ways to do it. And so sometimes we would get upset. Somebody would distribute a lot of books, but he would upset a lot of people. And so we weren't really happy about that. So, you know, even though he was distributing a lot of books, we didn't like it. We didn't like the way he did it and so forth. And that would come to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada would never go with that. He would never vibrate on that level. He would always say, he's doing wonderful service. If you think you can do better, then do it. So it was always keeping the energy positive. Because you can imagine, here's a person who's doing phenomenal service, right? Here's a person, they're doing phenomenal service. They're enthusiastic, they're enthusing others. Now, if Prabhupada says what they're doing is kind of bogus, it's kind of tamasic, it's shudra-like, it's not good and so forth, how discouraged will that person become? They'll feel like, what's the use? And that's the person the devotees were talking about, was one of the leaders of book distribution who was making it happen. So Prabhupada would never discourage that person. All he would tell his other disciples is, if you think you can do better, then show. So it was all very positive. He didn't have to he could, in a sense, acknowledge that it could be done better without it saying that. Saying, so, if you think you can do better, show. But he never said it was wrong. So it's very interesting. That way he could encourage both at the same time. Then, another very interesting story, I don't know if I told you, but you have to meditate on this because it's got a lot of ramifications. Two of my godbrothers were with Prabhupada and they were both book distributors. And they got to talk to Prabhupada about book distribution. And one of them was a very systematic thinker. And so in his systematic thinking, he thought we should develop a book distribution manual. You know, step-by-step process, how to distribute books, and then we should train devotees through that process. So they presented that idea. I don't know exactly how it was presented, but that's the basic idea. It would be a training program. This is how to sell books. This is how you approach people. This is what you say. This is when you say it. This is how you ask for the donation. This is how you get more money, and so on, like that. So, Prabhupada wasn't very enthused about it. It's not that he was totally against it. He said, it's okay. And then he said, but it's a little artificial. What do you think Prabhupada meant by it's a little artificial? Yeah. Everyone has an individualistic approach to how they do service. So Prabhupada then said the famous quote, I don't know who said it, but he quoted, every man is his own genius. So Prabhupada was very weary of bureaucracy. Bureaucracy means you get controlled and you lose spontaneity and creativity, and you just kind of get pushed in a particular direction. He didn't like bureaucracy because he felt bureaucracy would kill the devotional spirit. So, you know, there's some liabilities when you let people loose to do whatever they want. They may do something wrong. But I think Prabhupada felt the liabilities were far worth tolerating for the result you get in terms of person's individual creativity not being hampered. So, if you look at how Prabhupada dealt with devotees, he was encouraging them to go forward in services they had never done before. And they were very young. It wasn't like 60-year-old men who had life experience. It was 20-year-olds who had very little life experience, who all were college, just coming out of college. And, you know, college is not real life. So not much real life experience. And they were beginning to do things they'd never done before, and he was always encouraging it by saying, Krishna will give you intelligence. So this was Prabhupada's faith. It wasn't so much faith in our ability, it was faith in Krishna's giving intelligence. And so, therefore, we were encouraged to go beyond our limitations. You know, I don't know who said it, there's a saying, he said, all anybody wants is somebody to just help them be as good or be better than they, at least be better than they think they can be. Someone who, behind you. I was talking to a man who was encouraging me to do workshops in corporations because he had taken one of my workshops and he said, there's so much positivity in what you're teaching that would really be good for the corporation. And he made a really good point. He said, we're talking about leaders, and he said, employees don't want people telling them to do. Employees want people empowering them, showing them how to tap into their resources. And that's what Prabhupada did. He didn't micromanage. He gave us encouragement and courage, and faith in our and faith in our ability to connect with Krishna to do wonderful service. So you could say Prabhupada was the ultimate motivator, but he motivated with very few words, by acknowledging I'm very happy. Please continue. This is my Guru Maharaj was so pleased when we did this distributed books. Continue in this way, you'll receive his blessings. Just positive. So naturally, the devotees would go out for another year to distribute books, despite, you know, every year you do book distribution, you go through the winter, hot summers, you know. Sometimes you think, this is the last year. I can't do this. I'll go out on the weekends. I can't do it every day. But Prabhupada was so encouraging. And just the next year, you go out again and again. He was so pleased. So we can learn a lot from this. And we can learn a lot about ourselves. If we're focused on the negative in others, then what mode of nature are we in? We have to reflect on that. That the pure devotee, they only see the good. That's all they want to see. And it's all they have to see. Now, you might say, but the guru's duty is to criticize. Yes, that's his duty. And Prabhupada said it's a thankless task. So the guru, so he comes to the second class platform, and then he can discriminate between different levels of bhakti, and he must find fault in order to correct. That's his duty. But that's not his bhav, it's not his nature. Might be our nature to find fault. Say, I'm a teacher, I'm a guru, I find fault. That may be just my nature. So yeah, I make a great guru because I find fault with everybody. But Prabhupada said it's a thankless task because it's not the nature of a pure devotee to find fault. But he has to do it as a service. So that's different. We don't have to do it as a service. Most of us, we don't have that service to find fault. But we do a really good job of taking up that service, even though it's not ours. Right? So when one devotee was finding fault and complaining to Bhaktisiddhanta, then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said, I have to find fault because I'm guru. And it's a thankless task. And you don't, because you're not a guru. You don't have to. So why would you want to? It's like, you know, a sannyasi. Let's say you have a sannyasi in ISKCON, and one day you see him with a suit and tie. Say, where are you going? He said, I'm going to work. Why? Oh, get some money. And you're going to work every day, and you hate it, and you wish you were a sannyasi preaching. And in your mind, you're thinking, you're a sannyasi. You don't have to go to work. Why would you want to go to work? Right? So it's like this. You're not a guru. Why would you want to find fault? You don't have to. I do. I have to. That's painful. Because it's said in scripture, one who finds fault is not a Vaishnava. So now you have a job where you have to act like a non-Vaishnava. That's called guru. So he's saying, I have to act like a non-Vaishnava to find fault. You don't. Well, why would you want to do it? It doesn't make sense. So we can learn a lot from Prabhupada's example. Another thing that I saw with Prabhupada is that, at least, there was one story where he came to the Los Angeles temple, and at this point it was 1975, and Los Angeles had many, many departments. It was the center of the BBT for North America. It had a huge warehouse where all the books were stored. It had the entire art department who was painting all the books. It had the complete press who was doing all the laying out, the editing, the Sanskrit editing, the proofing. It had the Golden Avatar Studios, where the studios were responsible for recording all of Prabhupada's lectures and all the kirtans that we have, you know, on CD, all of that. Of course, the Los Angeles Temple was there, 350 devotees. And then the FATE exhibition, which was a museum in Los Angeles, first American theistic exhibition. So there's a group of devotees building the dioramas for that. So they had a place. I think they had part of the BBT warehouse. There was a section. And they were building, and they were developing the old Los Angeles Temple room into a museum. And we had huge Sankirtan parties. So there was a lot going on there. Maybe there were a few other departments. So they gave Prabhupada a tour. And every department he went, he would go in and say, just do art, you know, if he went into the fate department, he said, oh, just do build dioramas for Krishna. You know, use your artistic talent for Krishna. Then they go to the art department, just paint for Krishna. Then you go to Golden Avatar Studios, go, just sing for Krishna. Then he'd go to the press and just do this kind of brahminical work for Krishna. Then he'd go to the warehouse, or they had Spiritual Sky Business, do business for Krishna. Wherever he would go, he would say, do that for Krishna. So the idea was, do anything for Krishna, just do something for Krishna. That was his attitude. And so, why did Prabhupada say that? Because he knew that if we're not serving, we're going to get in trouble, right? Like, that's just the reality of Krishna consciousness. So he was saying, doesn't so much matter what you're doing, just be engaged in doing something that inspires you. So he was, you know, Prabhupada could be very, very, very blissful and very carefree and very accepting. So in this case, that's what he was like. Just paint for Krishna, sing for Krishna, distribute books for Krishna. It was like everything was fine. Whatever inspires you. So my realization from this and from seeing how Prabhupada dealt with devotees is that he knew how important enthusiasm was to create stability in Krishna consciousness. And so that he was always very careful to always fan that spark of enthusiasm, whatever it was that a devotee had. And you'll see, if you go through Prabhupada's letters, and I was mentioning this before, an interesting phenomena where devotees had different services and Prabhupada would write back and say, your service is the most important, to different people doing different things. And so, you know, you might think, how could that be? But in one sense, you could say what Prabhupada is saying, for you, that's the most important. Like, you're preaching, this work you're doing, getting the books in the universities, that's the most important. This work you're doing in the political field, running for office, that's the most important. A lot of times he said the college preaching was the most important. Of course, book distribution was the most important. One time he told a Bhajari, just by taking care of the deities, you'll go back to Godhead. So that's your service. This is your... Or we said last week, where Prabhupada said to a Bhajari who was neglecting their child, your puja is child puja. He actually told her to stop deity worship and do child puja. So that's the most important thing for you. So the idea is, he wanted devotees to be inspired, and he wanted them to think, what I'm doing is the most important. This is like, this service is so important. So that way we would absorb our mind and senses and just be, you know, feel this connection to Prabhupada, that I'm doing what he wants me to do, what's pleasing. So he always kept that mood, that very positive, enthusiastic mood that would fan that spark. Because he knew if we felt comfortable in our service and were inspired, we were good. Everything was fine. And in another letter he said that if the devotee is inspired in their service, they'll be inspired in their sadhana. They'll just go together. When you lose inspiration in service, you tend to lose inspiration in sadhana. They're just like right and left arm. Like the body doesn't have energy, the limbs don't have energy. So I never really saw, although Prabhupada, you know, he pushed book distribution, because I think it's obvious if he didn't, it wouldn't have happened. Because in the early days of the movement, it wasn't really happening. I mean, he'd talk about it, but nobody really put two and two together and really pushed it. It happened later, where devotees figured out that Prabhupada really wants this. They started making it happen. And so he needed to push that for it to happen. But there's so many other things, services, that he said were most important. So everybody felt their service was most important. And he never made you feel, oh, you're not doing book distribution anymore? What's wrong with you? Let's talk. You know, that would be like, you know, It's like, as soon as a Sankirtan devotee doesn't want to do book distribution, it's like, okay, let's bring him into the temple president with about four other people. It's like, you know, like those movies, you know, the detective's got you under a light, slapping you in the face, you know, keeping you awake all night. Okay, tell the truth. You know. A little bit like that, you know. Okay, what's going on here? You don't want to do book distribution. You know, what's wrong with you? Why, you know? What? Trying to get married? What? Lusty? You know, what is it? You know? You got a girlfriend you didn't tell anybody? What's going on here? It was a little bit like that. But Prabhupada never made you feel that way. It was like if you couldn't do a service, in most cases, unless he appointed you to do a service, there was no one to replace you, something like that. But in most cases, it was like, okay, so someone else will do it. You can do this service. It was always about being engaged. For devotees in general. As leaders, it's going to be different. But for devotees in general, it was the rank and file. It's like, okay, it's not, you can't do this anymore. He never made you feel bad. Unless that was, you know, he appointed you in a post like temple president of somewhere. Why are you leaving? You know, that's, you know, why are you giving up this responsibility? Didn't want us to give up responsibility. But it's just as a general principle, he didn't make you feel bad. So one of my godbrothers told me a story that indicates this. He said that this godbrother was the first devotee to go to Mexico and Venezuela and maybe some other South American countries. So he completely opened it up, and he was the main man that opened up Mexico and Latin America. And then I think it must have been about 1977, he kind of wasn't able to maintain his family and still be fully engaged in devotional service. But for some reason, he had to take a back seat. And so up to this point, he was at the forefront of preaching, opening temples, and developing them. So he went to see Prabhupada, and he was very, very embarrassed because he wasn't doing really much now. He was just working. I don't know what he was doing. He might have been selling spiritual sky incense or something. But he wasn't in the forefront like before. So he told me that he went to Prabhupada and he saw him because he was very close to Prabhupada, one of the leaders. And he kind of sheepishly, that means like a sheep, kind of. Sheeps are humble, have you noticed? So sheepishly means kind of with shame. He told Prabhupada, I'm not really doing much now, I'm just working. So as we were saying earlier, we often felt bad and we often felt we were failing Prabhupada, but he never indicated that. And Prabhupada just said to him, he said, well, you have to do something to make money. You have to do something to support yourself. So for Prabhupada, it was just normal. You're a grihastha and have to do something to get money. So he didn't say, why? Why aren't you opening temples? Why? Why did you give up this service? What's wrong with you? What's the trouble? Let's sit down and talk. Let's do a little psychotherapy. It wasn't like that at all. It was just, well, have to do something to make money. And I think we can understand that that as a pure devotee, like I was saying before, we might get some pleasure out of making somebody feel bad. You know, in some perverted way, we might get some pleasure if we say something nasty to somebody. Like, so the godbrothers tells me, well, I'm not preaching anymore. I'm just doing business, making money. I'm not doing much. And if I'm in the wrong consciousness, I'll get some pleasure about saying, say something nasty to him. Or derogatory. What's wrong with you? Why can't you, you know? You and Maya? What? And so, as we said before, because Prabhupada is on such an exalted level of Krishna consciousness, those kinds of things would never come from him. It's not possible. Those are the kind of things that come from us because of where we're at. And it's just, there's so many instances of Prabhupada's encouragement and affection. Now, if you listen to any interviews by women, one of the things that you'll find, I think amongst all of them, is they'll say, they always felt Prabhupada's affection. And sometimes with men, Prabhupada would push a little more, be heavy, but with women, he was softer, 99% of the time. You don't find it. It's just that he was heavy or chastising, and always treat them very gently, because that's the way you're supposed to, you know, a man should treat a woman. So they would say they always felt that kind of protection and that affection. There's an example of this. There's an interesting example which shows how Prabhupada's thinking. There's an example that I told this story before, and it's kind of amazing and it's weird. And it's 1976, I believe, there was a GBC resolution put forward by some of the senior sannyasis who were traveling throughout America, who were feeling that brahmacharis traveling with sannyasis is like the ultimate formula. And that if you allow women in the movement, that means all those brahmacharis will get allured away from brahmachari life. And then you'll lose your brahmacharis and you'll lose the strength. So they came up based on this idea. One of the things they were doing was getting brahmacharis to leave the temples and join their traveling party, because they figured if the brahmacharis stay in the temple, because there's single women there, it's just a matter of time before they get married, and what could be worse than that? That's like, you know, probably worse than dying, right? For them, you know. You know, maybe you could kill yourself instead of getting married. That would probably be better for you, right? So, wow, it's late. So they passed a resolution, and the resolution was that all women in the movement will be shipped to Australia. I don't know why Australia, maybe. Okay, let's take a little side point here. I just want you to understand that any Prabhupada disciple that's still serving in ISKCON is incredible, because this is the kind of stuff that we were dealing with, you know, the kind of crazy stuff that we had to tolerate. And I'm not even a woman, and I had to tolerate it. What to speak of the women? So, as was customary, after the GBC meetings, they would go to Prabhupada and they would read the resolutions, and Prabhupada would say, okay, okay, okay. So they were reading the resolutions one by one by one, and then he's saying, okay, okay, okay. And they came to this resolution, and he didn't say anything. I get the impression, I don't remember the story exactly, but when I heard the story, I got the impression he was just looking at the resolution, or maybe he was closing his eyes. Because otherwise he would just say, okay, this is good, next one, yeah, this is good, and that one. He didn't say anything. And so Satsarupa Maharaj was the one who was presenting these resolutions to Prabhupada, and he was making notes that which ones were accepted or rejected. So he was sensitive enough to realize that without Prabhupada saying anything, he didn't approve of that. And he said, so we should delete, what's the word when you, what's the word I'm looking for?
Oppose.
Oppose, or, yeah. Get rid of. Okay. Not delete, there's another word. Annul, I don't know. Some way. So we should drop this one. And Prabhupada only said one thing, as far as I remember. Well, I think he read it and then he went, hmm. So, you know, that's not okay. It's, hmm. And then he said something to the effect that I just want everyone to be Krishna conscious. And there was a concern about single women living in temples with children. And this came up and he said, it was really hard for Prabhupada to say, no, you can't. It wasn't his mood to say, go out and live on your own. He wanted to create communities and Sangha for everyone. So he just wanted to create this community and environment where everyone could live and be happy. Now, if Prabhupada's leaders did something, acted in ways or treated devotees in ways, the devotees were unhappy. He was very, very upset. Because he was very, very concerned about devotees' spiritual health. And as you may know, if someone is not a good leader, they have immense potency for disturbing the minds of others. It's like they have special shakti to create disturbance. And we've all seen this. And some people, they're just not good leaders. They don't know how to lead. As soon as they get in power, they become autocrats. And they're very, very demanding. Or they just become really detached and the whole temple space is out and they don't care about anything. You know, they're just, it's a certain person that knows how to do it. So in either case where devotees' needs are not being well met, Prabhupada was very upset. We would get angry. So he was very, very concerned that everyone would have a place in Krishna consciousness and everyone would be happy. You know, there's sometimes when Prabhupada noticed devotees, it didn't seem like they were, it seemed like they might be sick or getting sick, then he would tell the temple president, make sure they have warm cloth, they have what they need, it's your duty. So it was very concerned in that way. He's, you know, we're dedicating our lives to Krishna consciousness. He wants to make sure we're materially and spiritually we're taken care of. So we'll end here. And if you have any questions or comments, you can ask me. There's a comment here. There's a question here I'll read. When someone is in a mode of finding fault, it seems like they want someone to endorse their reasons. Yes. That's why we have the internet. So you can find fault and other people can chime in. And you can create a whole movement if you get enough people. So when you try to redirect energy or move it to a positive with that person, you get the sense that they get frustrated, those nearby, when their fault-finding isn't acknowledged. Yeah. So we'll write a book called Empathic Fault-Finding. When other people find fault, you reflect. So what you're saying is, this guy's an idiot, a demon, a jerk, and the biggest rascal you've ever seen. You must be feeling really upset. No, we don't want to do that. That would be empathic fault finding. It's true what he's saying. You get the sense they get frustrated, those who are chiming in, when their fault finding isn't acknowledged, or the ones who are fault finding. It's almost like they don't want to move forward unless the feeling is endorsed by someone near them. But you don't want to do that because it will keep the devotee fixed in that rasa. Yeah, it's true. Maybe you can break the energy. You want to open the windows now? This is an interesting point. You know, I think if I'm with someone and they're finding fault, I think there's something wrong with me. You know why? Because it makes me think that the person thinks it's okay to find fault. I mean, it's okay with me. If you're next to me, if somebody's finding fault and I'm around, then I think, don't you know I don't like to find fault? And if you're finding fault with someone in my presence, that means you think I like doing it. I'm that kind of person that would like doing it. So I kind of take it like an insult, in a sense. So, you know, you think I like this kind of stuff? You know what I mean? So I think maybe when that happens, you can show that you don't like that kind of stuff, and that you try to neutralize that environment because it's destructive. You know, there's this man, this guy, quite well known in America. He teaches a workshop, and the principle of his workshop is that everybody has a mental blueprint. A mental blueprint is kind of like a plan that indicates what their life will be like, you know, the way all the samskaras, if you understand all the samskaras, if you talk to somebody, ask them some questions, you can kind of understand, man, there's samskaras. What do you think about this? What do you believe about that? What are your thoughts on this? So they give him their thoughts on life, and he said, in 5 minutes I can predict your future. If I just talk to you and see you for 5 minutes, I can know your future just by what you believe, what your attitudes are, how you think. So in the same way, if you go into an environment where there's a lot of criticism, a lot of fault finding, you can pretty accurately predict the future. And that company, whether it's a company in ISKCON or outside of ISKCON, that company is going to hit a point where they're just going to barely maintain. That's about as best as they can do. They'll always be a day or two away from just crashing. You ever been around temples that seem like they're going to crash any day? Yeah. So often if you trace out the history, there's going to be a history of a lot of discouragement, negativity, not just mismanagement, but mismanagement in the form of allowing this kind of negative atmosphere to come. And then it can explode and really be self-destructive. So it's just law of nature. So at least we should be agents to neutralize that kind of thing by not showing interest. And if there's no interest, then you know, who are they going to talk to? There won't be anybody left to talk to. You can say, Prabhu, why don't you go to the other camp, because they love to talk about ISKCON, but around here we're trying to, you know, it doesn't help us. So, Dustin, I have a principle, and it works like this. It's like, you know, there's an 80-20 principle. I just read there's a 20-60-20 principle. Actually, I can't remember what it relates to. But the 20-80 principle is 20% of what you do will produce 80% of your results. So we can have the 1-99 principle. Instead of 20 to 80%, we'll have 1% to 99%. And the 1% is you point out the problem, and the 99% is you discuss and act on the solution. So if you only get 1% for the problem, you don't get to talk about it very long. Just go, you know, we have a problem, this, that, and the next thing. Okay, that's the problem, we got it. Let's do the solution. So that's how you can also neutralize. So when people are complaining, you can just say, we all know this, we all understand it. Let's talk about solution. What are we going to do to make it better? That makes sense, right? So in these losing situations, people will just continually talk about what's wrong. They won't talk about what's right. And that was the point with Prabhupada. Whenever you did something wrong, he'd always say, how to rectify it. So you always focus on, okay, this was wrong, but you focus your energy on what you should do. That was Prabhupada. That's why Prabhupada was successful. And did Prabhupada have things to complain about? He could complain about a lot of things. He was dealing with us. We were pretty, you know, useless in many ways. So if he wanted to complain, he had, you know, 5,000 disciples to complain about. I mean, I was, when I was young and trying to be a devotee, I was very enthusiastic and very sincere, but not very experienced in life. And not, you know, very intelligent. I never thought I was very smart. I just thought I could, you know, if Prabhupada wanted me to do something, I would just mess it up. So I just thought, well, let me just distribute books. How much can you mess up doing that? So it wasn't like Prabhupada had a lot of great men. But still, he didn't complain about us. His godbrothers complained about us, and he defended us. Anything? Questions? Comments? Yeah. Yes.
Kind of like a share. When I did national communications for Prabhupada's Centennial in India, I came up against a lot of resistance and obstacles. And of course, you can't always be liked by everybody. And
resistance because? From who and why?
Resistance in the sense that people didn't quite grasp the concept of communication, the principles of communication, and communication's background. So there was a sort of an intellectual competition about what would work and what would not work. But because I was a very junior devotee at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
I'm gonna
transfer this to you. Let's see how far it goes. Yeah. Okay, it's got a long cable. But now that it's stuck on my garland. Oh my god. Okay. You know how it works? You can't figure out how it got on, but somehow you can never get it on. Maybe we'll just... I have some encouraging news. Steve Jobs said, ideas reign supreme, not rank.
So, why don't you just explain what you just said?
So, as a very junior devotee in 1994, 1995, I was sent to India by my spiritual master, Mukunda Goswami, to take on national communications for Prabhupada's centennial. And of course, I wasn't known at the time. I just took my very first initiation shortly before I arrived in India. And rather than looking at my experience and my qualifications as a public relations consultant before I joined the movement, they were looking at me as someone that were just taking initiation, so he's very junior. So because he's very junior in his spiritual life in ISKCON, he could not possibly be qualified to take on a post that is going to promote Prabhupada's centennial in India. And after all, he has a white body. And Mukunda Maharaj called me in and said that you would have a lot of obstacles, there would be resistance from the hierarchy, and that's fine, but always remember that you should seek out the like-minded devotee. Seek out the like-minded devotee, and that's the one that you can influence and who can influence you. So it's a mutual beneficial relationship there. And for those that obstruct you or criticize you or want to put you down, all you do is show respect and move on. Because in India there's a saying, even if when the elephant walks and the dogs keep barking, the elephant keeps walking. It just keeps walking. And eventually the dog will just give up and go away. And I think what you've just said too, that ideas will ultimately be triumphant. So I think seeking out like-minded devotees and mutually inspire one another is maybe the recipe that has worked for me since 1985.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Actually, I was just recently studying or reading a lot about Sangha, the effects of Sangha, and the value that advanced association can give you. It can knock you up very high in Krishna consciousness in ways you can't get on your own, and vice versa. And that bad association can really pull you down. And I had been somehow or other I had been reading things not written by devotees, but written by non-devotees who were talking about the devastating effects of bad association. How it's destructive, how you have to distance yourself from negative people and destructive people, because it's like carrying weights on your shoulder trying to climb a mountain. You can't do it. Or maybe it's more like someone has a rope. You're trying to walk and they have a rope and they're pulling you. So I was surprised to see how many people had that realization. Even maybe a little more intense than devotees, where people were saying, I had some family members that were so negative that I actually had to separate from them because I couldn't function normally. Or I couldn't achieve my goals. They were so jealous, you know, that they hadn't done what I was doing. Actually, Oprah Winfrey said that. So I thought that interesting. Anyway, and then the devotee who asked that question is saying, well, when you don't participate in those discussions, they get frustrated with you. Which I guess is a good sign. Anyway, you know what Prabhupada said, we're not going to destroy, ISKCON's not going to be destroyed from the outside, it'll be destroyed from the inside. I think this is one of the ways, I think it's already being destroyed from the inside, it's just that it's maintaining, you know, it's a skeleton in many places, but it's basically been destroyed because of this kind of negativity and what it could be. I could give you an example. You might go somewhere and you think, well, things are nice here, but what it could be if things were different. And I was distributing books once, and I was kind of proud somebody, I got a, you know, in those days, if you got a $20 donation, that was like the most anybody got. So I met somebody, I talked to him, and then what he said, how much did you get from him? I said, I got $20. And they chastised me, said, I would have got $100 from him. Because he was just this simple guy who had just been paid and had a lot of money, and if you would have pushed him, he would have given you more. So then I realized that I wasn't, you know, living up to my potential as a book distributor, taking advantage. So you might sometimes see temples that looks okay, but you could imagine what they could be like if the energy were more positive. So I see that in many places, how destructive it is. Because then you ever get in a fight, then you have to put all your energy in to make up. It's easier not to get in a fight, isn't it? It's at least it's more efficient, more economical time-wise. I realized that early on in marriage. Fighting is like it's a real time waster. You waste time while you're fighting, and you waste even more time making up. It takes longer, I think. Doesn't it? I can't remember. I don't fight with my wife. But in the early days, if I ever had a fight, I always remember it was always very time consuming. And then it always takes you, like, if it's a really bad fight, it takes you like 2 or 3 days to get back to normal. You're so disturbed. So, yeah, it's horrible. Okay, so we can end now. We can learn from Prabhupada how to be positive and encouraging. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gopremanandi, Hari Hari Bol.